Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Monday, May 13th. I'm Ray Graff. Support for Medical Monday comes from Coxsackie Dental Arts, helping patients smile with confidence for over 20 years, caring about patients' health and happiness. Information at CoxsackieDentist.com. Joining us this afternoon for Medical Monday is Dr. J.D. Philippone, Chief of Cardiology at St. Peter's Hospital. He practices with Albany Associates in Cardiology, part of St. Peter's Health Partners Medical Associates. Dr. Philippone is board certified in heart failure and transplant and has served as director of St. Peter's Cardiac Critical Care Unit and Heart Failure Clinic. The number to call if you have a question, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, or email voxpop@wamc.org. We'll be back right after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. It's Medical Monday, and joining us in Studio A today is J.D. Philippone, Chief of Cardiology at St. Peter's Hospital. He practices with Albany Associates in Cardiology, which is part of St. Peter's Health Partners Medical Associates. Dr. Philippone is board certified in heart failure and transplant and has served as director of St. Peter's Cardiac Critical Care Unit and Heart Failure Clinic. A native of the Capital Region, Dr. Philippone obtained his medical degree from the University of Rochester and completed his post-grad training in internal medicine and cardiology at Strong Memorial Hospital. If you have a question, this is the time to get in the queue. 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. There's a lot of letters. Dr. J.D. Philippone, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Are all of your colleagues listening over at the hospital right now?
Probably none of them. I don't know.
You see, I get that a lot, believe me. Let me tell you. So, you know, congestive heart failure. Somebody told me today that 6 million Americans have this. And it's not an instant killer. Is it a killer of everybody? My grandmother had it and lived another. She lived till she was 95.
Right. So, no, it's not an instant killer, and most of the time it's a chronic disease. And, yeah, the prevalence is estimated to be about 6 million or so in the U.S., and, you know, we see that growing mostly because of, you know, an aging population, and we've become better at treating coronary disease, which is one of the main causes of heart failure. So as we become better at treating coronary disease, people are not dying as early in the disease stage of coronary disease, they're living longer and developing heart failure. So it's very much a chronic disease.
Now, when they say heart failure, most of us who are not doctors say, well, your heart's just failed, you're going to die. But tell us exactly what congestive heart failure actually is.
Yeah, so I usually start by, you know, telling patients, listen, this doesn't mean your heart's falling apart, just as you said, and that you're going to die in a matter of days. So when we say congestive heart failure, we're talking about a set of symptoms. It's really a syndrome that's defined as a set of symptoms that's caused by some problem with the heart that has caused pressure to elevate in the chambers of the heart. And as the pressure elevates in the chambers of the heart, that can produce shortness of breath, fluid retention, and a whole cascade of pathophysiologic changes that lead to these symptoms: shortness of breath, fluid retention, leg swelling, and that's what we call heart failure. There's a large number of conditions that can cause heart failure and can cause, you know, disease of the heart muscle and lead to this.
You know, I mentioned my grandmother. She got it. I don't know. I think she lived about 10 years, and I don't even know if she died of that, but it seemed fairly manageable with medication.
Yeah, so for some patients, it can be very manageable, and they can live a long time, and they wind up dying from something else. And for other patients, you know, it can have a more rapid progression, and they can decline more quickly. So there's a broad spectrum of disease when we talk about heart failure, and there could be people who live for decades and other patients who don't, you know, live months without getting something like a transplant.
Do people know when they have it all the time?
So, no. So they're definitely, so I guess we should sort of, I should make this point that there's two main categories of heart failure, and we used to call it systolic heart failure, meaning there's a problem with the pumping function of the heart, and diastolic heart failure, meaning there's a problem with how the heart relaxes. We now call this heart failure with reduced ejection fraction, meaning weakness of the pumping function of the heart, or heart failure with preserved ejection fraction, meaning the heart pumps normally but doesn't relax well. Either of these disease states can lead to heart failure symptoms. Now, to get at your question about do people know they have this, there certainly are people, a large proportion of people, who can have weakness of the heart muscle and not know it, not necessarily have symptoms from it. And we would call that weakness of the heart muscle a cardiomyopathy, meaning weakness of the heart muscle, but they don't necessarily have the symptoms of heart failure. They're not clinically in heart failure. Mm. But if a patient is clinically in heart failure, the pressure in the heart is elevated and they're filling up with fluid and out of breath, they would usually know this. You know, they would experience those symptoms. But again, people can definitely have underlying weakness of the heart muscle, underlying stiffness of the heart muscle, and not yet have developed symptoms.
What is this business about relaxation of the heart? Explain what you're talking about there.
So the heart pumps and then relaxes. Pumping is its main function, to, you know, pump blood out of the heart and deliver blood and oxygen to the tissues. And then in diastole, which is the relaxation phase, the heart muscle relaxes, and that's when it fills. So it's a pump that squeezes and then relaxes and fills again. And so when people have heart failure because the pump's not squeezing well, we call that heart failure with reduced ejection fraction. Ejection fraction is a measure of how much blood is pumped out of the heart with each beat. When the heart squeezes normally, normal ejection fraction, but doesn't relax well, we call that heart failure with preserved ejection fraction. And in this subset of patients, they have stiffness of the heart muscle, and the heart pumps normally but doesn't relax well. And as it tries to relax, the pressure in the heart increases very quickly. It's like a stiff bag instead of a compliant chamber. And that stiffness leads to elevation of the pressure in the heart and translates into shortness of breath and fluid retention.
We're joined today by Dr. J.D. Philippone, Chief of Cardiology at St. Peter's Hospital. If you have a question, give us a shout, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org, voxpop@wamc.org. So you have done heart transplants?
No, those are done by a cardiac surgeon, okay? So the cardiac surgeon is actually the one who performs the transplant. And transplant cardiologists are the ones who evaluate patients with very advanced heart failure, reduced ejection fraction, take care of those patients leading up to the transplant and then after the transplant. We don't perform, when I say we, nowhere in the Capital District is heart transplant performed right now. Hmm. So we still manage these patients who are sick enough that they need that kind of therapy. But when they ultimately need that defining event of the heart transplant, we send them out of town.
Are you in charge of the list? The famous list, the waiting list to get the hearts?
So, no, I'm not in charge of that. And
no.
So designated transplant centers where they perform transplants have transplant teams that evaluate patients and decide whether or not to list them for transplant. To some extent, those teams are in charge of where people go on the list, but there are very strict rules about, you know, how patients are categorized. And it's really how sick the patient is that determines where they go on the list.
Yeah. Now, how long can we expect the average heart transplant patient to remain alive?
I mean, the average length of time is 10 years.
Really? Yeah. Has that grown over the years? How long have they been doing these?
So it's definitely improved over the last several decades. You know, these patients need to be on a lot of immunosuppression, drugs to suppress the immune system so that the recipient of the heart transplant doesn't reject the organ. And a lot of the complications of transplant are the result of the immunosuppression, right? So the patient can't fight off other infections. The immunosuppressants can cause kidney disease, can actually cause coronary disease of the transplanted organ. So the immunosuppression regimens have improved, and that's part of the reason that People are living longer with transplant, and patient selection has improved. In other words, choosing the right patient who's going to do well and live longest with the transplant.
So in other words, if I come to you and say, hey, you know, I need a heart transplant, but you take a look and say, well, you're in lousy shape, you're not going to make the list. That's got to be a tough call to make.
Yeah. So now, fortunately, heart transplant is you know, not the only therapy available for people who require what we call advanced therapy. So,
I'm sorry, I got off track, but I heard heart transplant and I got very excited.
No, I mean, it's a good question. So this is something that we consider for patients who have weakness of the heart muscle. Again, heart failure with reduced ejection fraction, who have very severe weakness of the heart muscle, despite medical therapy, are still doing really poorly with poor quality of life. That's the type of patient that we would evaluate for what we call advanced heart failure therapies. One of those therapies is transplant. The other therapy is something called mechanical circulatory support, or something called an LVAD, which stands for left ventricular assist device, which is basically a mechanically implanted heart pump. And the reason that this is important is because there just are not enough transplants, organs to go around for everyone who needs one. And so when you deem someone not a good transplant candidate because you don't think they have other comorbidities such that they might not survive the surgery, they might not do well with immunosuppression, there are other options for that patient.
Yeah.
So.
All right. Well, I'm sorry. You know, I hijack shows all the time with going on tangents.
Well, it's your show.
Hey, you know, Barney Clark, lived 100 days with a Jarvik 7 when I was a kid, the 70s.
Right.
Did they pretty much just say, nah, the mechanical hearts we're not going to do for this the next 100 years? Because I haven't heard much about them since the 70s.
Well, they actually have come a long way. And, you know, the technology of these devices has advanced significantly so that they're safer and better tolerated. And we're actually seeing an increase in the number that
they
been
still
implanted.
Use
them. Absolutely.
Battery operated?
Absolutely.
How do you charge?
Yeah.
How do you power them up? Really?
With batteries, yep.
All right, I've totally gotten off track. We're talking about congestive heart failure and other things. J.D. Philippone is already irritated that he's here, but he's going to be here for the whole hour. It's a Medical Monday. 800-348-2551 is the number. And the voxpop@wamc.org is the email address. We'll be back. T-Bone Walker, there's some snappy music for a cardiac show. 800-348-2551 is the number. It's Medical Monday. Ray Graff with you. We're joined by Dr. J.D. Philippone, Chief of Cardiology at St. Peter's Hospital. And let's start with a couple of emails that came in earlier today, and then we'll go to the phones. This one is from Jill in Cornwall. Now, doctor, this is the first time you've done this show. If something you don't want to answer it, just give me a nod and we'll move on. But this is from Jill in Cornwall. I'm wondering when doctors will advise patients to treat their high HDL levels. I was told for over a decade that my ultra-high HDL number, around 100, was, quote, fantastic, with an exclamation point, and I was lucky. I started to get white rings around my irises, and a year later was diagnosed with Drusen's eye spots, which will lead to age-related macular degeneration. All of this caused by high HDL levels, says Jill. In addition, a recent study showed that high HDL leads to atherosclerosis in women. Why do so many physicians seem completely unaware of this? And that's from Jill in Cornwall. Have fun.
Yeah, Jill, that's a great question. So traditionally, HDL, which is what we high-density lipoprotein, which is good cholesterol, right? And then you have bad cholesterol, LDL. The bad cholesterol gets deposited in the arteries and causes blockages in cholesterol plaque, and then the good cholesterol, or HDL, is felt to go around and gobble up the bad cholesterol and bring it back to the liver. So the traditional teaching was having an HDL that's high is really, really good, and that sort of has been borne out in a lot of the the majority of cardiovascular research over the last many decades to the point where having an HDL that's low was considered a risk factor for developing coronary disease. And that's sort of how we've always approached this. There was a point when they actually tried, drugs were used to raise the HDL cholesterol because that was felt to be a good thing. Those drugs, you know, never really translated into reduction in heart attacks or making people live longer. So now we sort of don't treat the HDL, but sort of just observe it and recognize that a low HDL is a risk factor for coronary disease and a high HDL is felt to be good. That's sort of the traditional teaching. So you're right that more recently there was this there was a study that showed that really high HDL, and I don't remember the level of HDL they looked at in the study, that really high HDL may actually paradoxically be a risk factor for developing atherosclerosis. So this is something that is sort of being discussed more recently. And I don't know that we really know what to do with this right now or what this means. And I think that this really needs to be looked at in larger studies. Right now, there aren't really drugs that are being prescribed to lower the HDL. And again, we do know that having a low HDL is bad, and having a high HDL to a certain level seems to reduce the risk of coronary disease. It's this really, really high HDL that you're talking about, approaching 100 in this study that seemed to be a risk factor. So this was a surprising finding. It's a bit paradoxical. And you're right, I think that a lot of people aren't even aware of this one study.
All right, Jill, thanks for that one. This one's from Jay. Can chemotherapy cause congestive heart failure? Can it resolve itself after chemo is done? And that's from Jay.
Yeah, that's a great question. So the short answer is yes, chemotherapy can cause congestive heart failure. There are certain types of chemotherapy that can cause weakness of the heart muscle or a cardiomyopathy. There's a number of chemotherapies that can do this. There are specific chemotherapies that are very well known for doing this. For example, a class of chemotherapy called the anthracyclines, adriamycin, that is often given for breast cancer or lymphoma. And so that class of chemotherapy can definitely cause weakness of the heart muscle. There are some other breast cancer drugs that can do this as well. So the answer is yes. When these drugs are being administered, we've learned a lot more about the doses to use, what doses not to exceed, especially with the anthracyclines, and what doses sort of put people at increased risk for developing this. And we've become much better about monitoring patients with frequent imaging, frequent ultrasounds of their heart, measuring of blood tests to sort of predict and detect early on which patients might be developing a problem and then stopping that chemo if that happens. Once the damage is done, can it be reversed? It can, but not always, and it depends on the individual and the type of the chemotherapy.
All right, this one's from Amanda, and then we'll hit the phones. Dr. J.D. Philippone, Chief of Cardiology at St. Peter's, joins us. The number is 800-348-2551, and we will get back to the emails later in the program at voxpop@wamc.org. Amanda writes, my 17-year-old daughter has postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome. What is your experience with people outgrowing this condition? What are the best treatments? Doctor, what did I just read?
So you're talking about a condition that's commonly known as POTS, P-O-T-S, postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome. And this is a condition where when people change their posture, stand up, they'll develop tachycardia, which means the heart going fast, the heart races. So in the simplest terms, racing of the heart inappropriately when someone stands up. So these patients often get lightheaded and dizzy quite easily. Their heart may race inappropriately if they're standing for too long, or sometimes even when they're sitting down, and sometimes they can pass out. This is a condition that falls under the umbrella of something called autonomic dysfunction, or the dysautonomias. And what it is basically dysfunction of the autonomic nervous system, which is the part of the nervous system that controls automatic functions, like makes you breathe, controls your heart rate when you go running, makes your heart rate go up, it raises your prevents your blood pressure from plummeting when you stand up so you don't pass out. This is the autonomic nervous system does this. And when it malfunctions, you can get these conditions like POTS. It most commonly affects younger people, very often women. And we've actually seen a lot more of it. I think we're recognizing more of it now because we saw more of it related to COVID. We saw a lot of people who, and still see people who developed this autonomic dysfunction after COVID, and other viral illnesses can do it as well. So I think there's greater awareness of it now. There's a lot of different treatments. There's some basic lifestyle stuff that works, just drinking a lot of fluids, increasing the sodium intake to raise the blood pressure. Exercise has been shown to help. And sometimes people just sort of, as you said, grow out of it, and it goes as easily as it came. There are other medications available to raise the blood pressure for these patients, or to sometimes slow the heart rate down if fast heart rate's the main symptom. But some of these people can really, really struggle and be very symptomatic. And I always advise that those people seek out a dysautonomia clinic because this is a condition that a lot of people don't know a lot about, but there are experts at some of the larger academic centers who do and can sometimes be helpful to patients who are really struggling.
Is this a neurological issue or a cardiac issue?
Well, I mean, it's both. I mean, the heart, blood pressure, heart rate, heart contractility are to a large extent under the influence of the autonomic nervous system. So it is dysfunction of the autonomic component of the nervous system, but it very much manifests as cardiac symptoms because of its effects on blood pressure and heart rate.
Now, last question. You can feel free to ignore it, and then we'll go to the phones, or you can answer it. In your opinion, you said you saw an uptick post-COVID, or at least when the pandemic came. Is it possible that people were just freaked out and overly sensitive to all changes, and they've had the thing all along, or did the COVID cause this uptick in this wart or whatever you called it?
Yeah, it's a good question. I it has always been felt, this has always been felt to possibly be a post-viral syndrome, even before COVID.
Oh, okay.
So it's always been thought that viruses may be the inciting event for people developing these dysautonomia. So I do think the uptick is absolutely real. And some of, we don't just give this diagnosis because somebody presents with symptoms. There are objective measures that you can do in the office to see how the heart rate fluctuates.
No, of course.
So I really do think there was an objective increase in this after COVID.
All right, let's go to the phones now. 800-348-2551. Dr. J.D. Philippone joins us from St. Peter's Hospital. And we'll begin in Amsterdam. Cindy, you're on.
Hey, you're up.
Yeah, hi. I had a question about ingesting the high caffeine energy drinks and doing some intense aerobic activity and how that affects the heart.
So the question is ingesting the high caffeine energy drink and then going and exercising right afterwards?
Yeah. How does that affect the heart? Because I noticed occasionally you'll feel more fluttering or you can feel the heart beating harder.
Yeah. So caffeine and some of the other stimulants in these drinks, it's going to stimulate the heart. It increases the heart rate and can cause more of what we call ectopic beats, meaning extra or early beats from the top or bottom chamber of the heart. And caffeine alone can do that, but particularly these energy drinks. So it's not surprising that you feel more palpitations or fluttering after drinking one of these, and you will probably see that your heart rate increases more readily and maybe a higher peak heart rate when you're exercising after drinking one of these. So they absolutely have an effect on the heart and in general, not a good one. I mean, it's not. No, I don't think that it's going to cause permanent damage, but it can provoke abnormal heart rhythms. Stimulants can provoke abnormal heart rhythms in people who are prone to them. So it's not like consuming that caffeinated drink or that energy drink is going to cause permanent heart damage. But if you're someone who's prone to go into a rapid abnormal heartbeat, are you going to be more likely to have that with one of these energy drinks? Absolutely. So it's better practice not to be doing that.
Cindy, thanks for the call. The number here is 800-348-2551. Dr. J.D. Philippone joins us from St. Peter's Hospital. So how much coffee do you guys consume over in the cardiology department over there? A lot?
No. I mean, there's none over there.
We took really? Oh, that's surprising.
No, I mean, yeah. So I drink coffee. I have a couple cups of coffee a day. And, you know, the pendulum has swung a bit on coffee in terms of its, health benefits.
It's good now?
Yeah.
Really?
It's good if you're not putting cream and sugar in it, which isn't the case for most people. But there was a time when it was felt to sort of have, you know, negative health consequences. But, black coffee without cream or sugar, if anything, may be good for you. But yes, as I said, you know, drinking caffeine and then going and exercising after a big yeah. bolus of caffeine or stimulants, probably not a good idea.
You know, I can't believe it. Okay. So I'm down to about a cup and a half a day. In radio, it's like a cardiology ward. We slug down a lot of coffee. I do everything in my life that is not necessarily good for me. And finally, I stopped the coffee and now it's good for me. This is unbelievable. Dr. J.D. Philippone joins us from St. Peter's Hospital. 800-348-2551 is the number. Phil in Saratoga, you're on.
Ray, can you hear me?
10-4, good buddy. Go ahead.
Ray?
Yeah, go ahead.
Ray, are you there? Love the show, Ray.
Thank you. You're on.
Doctor, my question... Okay. My question is about my wife. Over the last 10 months, she's had... three episodes of stress-induced cardiomyopathy. The first go-around, her ejection fraction was 15%. The last go-around, it went down to 30%. She's scheduled for an echocardiogram next week to see if things have returned back to normal. My question is, is she a candidate for chronic heart failure in the coming years?
So I think what you're talking about with stress-induced cardiomyopathy is that, you know, she presented with symptoms, cardiac symptoms, chest pain, breathing trouble perhaps, and they found weakness of the heart muscle. And I presume they did a heart catheterization that showed her coronary arteries were normal. Is that right?
Correct.
Yeah, so there is this condition called, stress-induced cardiomyopathy. It's often called apical ballooning syndrome or also Takotsubo cardiomyopathy. It's most commonly seen as in women, you know, as they approach their fifth and sixth decades, often in response to a severe emotional or physiologic stress. And we see a very typical pattern of weakness of the heart muscle on imaging studies, and the coronary arteries are normal. And but the heart can get very weak. It tends to carry a very good prognosis in that for the majority of patients, the pumping function of the heart returns to normal over a period of days to weeks. It sounds like your wife has been diagnosed with this twice. It can happen more than once. It's unusual. It can happen more than once. But again, most people, the pumping function of the heart returns to normal. So your ultimate question, I think, was does this predict a higher likelihood of your wife developing chronic heart failure? I think that it probably does. You know, she's had these two episodes of severe weakness of the heart muscle. So I think compared to, you know, a peer her age who hasn't had this happen, she's going to have a higher likelihood of chronic heart failure. But again, for the majority of patients, the ejection fraction goes back to normal, and they do not suffer with chronic heart failure.
Did you catch that, Phil?
Well, so the first episode, her ejection fraction returned to 60%, which we understood to be normal.
Yeah.
And as I say, she's scheduled for another echo, I believe, next week, and we'll see how far it's returned. But unfortunately, her parents both had heart issues later in life. And so I think this may all be contributory. And thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Phil, thanks for the call. 800-348-2551 is our number. It's Dr. J.D. Philippone, Chief of Cardiology at St. Peter's Hospital today. Let's grab one more before the next break, and we'll go to Matamoros, Pennsylvania. Jim, you're on.
Does
Does the aurora borealis have any effect on cardiac patients or pacemakers?
Do the northern lights have any effect on cardiac patients or pacemakers? What do you think, Dr. Philippone?
I'm not aware of any effect of the northern lights on heart disease or pacemaker.
Okay, and thanks for that, Jim. I think I know where you're going with that. We had rather extensive northern lights. There was a X4 solar flare this weekend, I think. And, that's a lot of energy coming from the sun and, pacemakers being electronic, right? They're electrical. Can you put your pacemaker, can you be too close to a microwave, for instance?
So, certain electromagnetic fields will interfere, with the pacemaker.
Yeah.
So, and that may have been what he was getting at with that question he said, but I'm not aware of anything with the northern lights. Okay, certain magnets, strong magnets will interfere with the pacemaker, certain welding equipment.
I've heard those induction stoves might be a no-no if you get too close. If the solar flare was strong enough on the surface of the Earth to interfere with a pacemaker, I think we have bigger problems than just that.
I think you're right.
The ionosphere saves us. Hey, Zach, before we get into a full-on science forum, let's take a break. 800, we'll reset. 800-348-2551. Cardiology today and your calls in a moment. Welcome back to Medical Monday. Ray Graff with you. 800-348-2551 is the telephone number. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org if you want to talk to Dr. J.D. Philippone, Chief of Cardiology at St. Peter's. We mentioned coffee earlier. A listener or two might have gotten the wrong impression that you were advocating. You're not a coffee achiever. You're not advocating for it. We just happened to mention that there's some science, not related to bone loss or anything else, that it does have some possible benefits, but you're not an advocate, right?
I'm not here to sell coffee.
All right, fair enough. Well, you got any? This email came in from Peter. Is it true that a heart attack due to blockage of main arteries at a younger age, say below 40 years old, may more likely be fatal because auxiliary systems have not built up yet as in older age?
Yes, there is some truth to that. So, heart attack, just as you said, occurs because of a blockage in one of the coronary arteries, which are the arteries that bring blood to the heart. And when that flow is interrupted, the heart muscle can start to, the part of the heart muscle dies. That's what a heart attack is. In patients with chronic coronary disease who have chronic blockages that develop slowly, they may experience angina for months or years, those patients can develop what we call collateral blood flow, where newer blood vessels sort of grow in to supply the areas of the heart muscle that aren't getting enough blood.
Yeah.
And then when that person has an abrupt occlusion of a heart vessel, because they've already developed collateral flow, they may not have as much heart damage as somebody who's never had angina before, never had significant blockages, and then develops an abrupt blockage. So, yes, there's some truth to what you're saying.
Number to call here is 800-348-2551. It's a Medical Monday. Dr. J.D. Philippone, Chief of Cardiology at St. Peter's, joins us. And let's go to Kingston. And Susan, you're on.
Hi, this is Susan.
Hello.
I was very excited about this. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Can you hear me?
I can. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Barely,
then let's do
a
show. Go ahead.
Okay. All right. Now, I heard something about breast cancer and medication and chemotherapy. It may be affecting the heart or could have. My older sister did have breast cancer. She did have chemo and a lot of other medications, but she's been cancer-free for about 10 years. About 4 years ago, she got Lyme meningitis, and it took her a while to recover from that. The problem is now, even though she had a pacemaker put in, she keeps getting lightheaded, dizzy. She passes out or she falls down. The doctors can't seem to find anything wrong. They think it's maybe a brain bleed, so they've been trying to do all MRIs, CAT scans. They still can't find anything wrong. I wonder if it was like the stoic thing where the heart doesn't quite pump everything out right.
Yeah, so, So first of all, if she had heart muscle damage from the chemotherapy and had weakness of the heart muscle, that's something that should be should be able to easily detect with ultrasound or echocardiogram of the heart. But you're asking, could she have normal pumping function of the heart and just have diastolic dysfunction or weak abnormality of relaxation of the heart from the chemotherapy?
Yes.
So the answer is yes. So most of the time with chemotherapy-related heart muscle damage, we see weakness of the heart muscle, but it can just cause abnormality of relaxation. That would typically cause shortness of breath. Could cause weakness, less commonly lightheadedness. But that's also something that can be evaluated on echocardiogram or ultrasound. You can there are features of the echo that allow you to see if there's abnormality of relaxation.
Susan.
Okay, well, they haven't found anything yet.
Yeah, I would say if her echo is totally normal, and you know, if other there's blood tests that can be done to see if people have evidence of elevated heart pressure. If those standard tests are totally normal, then it seems unlikely that this would be due to heart failure.
Okay.
Okay. Thanks for the call. We appreciate it. 800-348-2551 is the number if you have a question for Dr. J.D. Philippone. This email came into voxpop@wamc.org, and it doesn't say who it's from. My son was born with Vader syndrome. In turn, he had an ASD, VSD, an app window, and a double outlet right ventricle. He's had surgery, 2 months of age, to correct the holes in his heart. But does this mean he'll have more cardiac issues when he gets older?
Yeah, it's a great question. So it sounds like your son had pretty complex congenital heart disease, an atrial septal defect, the ASD, which is a hole between the two top chambers of the heart. A ventricular septal defect, a hole between the two bottom chambers of the heart. Both of those are more common congenital heart abnormalities than the others you described. I think you said double outlet right ventricle, much less common. And I have to say, I don't know a lot about that aspect of his condition. But what we know about congenital heart disease in general is that these patients are living a lot longer, fortunately, because the surgeries and post-surgical management has improved so much. So it's actually a new field over the last decade or more of what's called adult congenital heart disease, specialists who take care of these children as they age into adulthood. And there definitely can be other conditions that develop, abnormal heart rhythms, congestive heart failure as these patients age. And the risk of those things developing or likelihood of those things developing depends on the specific type of congenital heart disease that they've had. And I have to say that I don't know a lot about Vader syndrome specifically.
The number to call here is 800-348-2551. We're joined by Dr. J.D. Philippone, Chief of Cardiology at St. Peter's Hospital. And let's go now to Glenmont. Jim, you're on.
Yeah, hi, how you doing?
Hey.
I'd like my 72-year-old wife has AFib, and they're talking about possible ablation for her. She has high blood pressure, high cholesterol, takes six different medications a day, isn't in the best of health. How risky is that?
So ablation, you know, is a procedure where we put a catheter up into the heart to identify the abnormal circuit that's causing the abnormal heart rhythm and basically burn away that abnormal circuit with radio frequency energy. It's performed very commonly for atrial fibrillation. It's really for patients who are symptomatic from their atrial fibrillation and despite medications. So the procedure has come a long way and is much safer than it was, 15 years ago. So in general, it's a very safe procedure. There is a small risk of stroke associated with the procedure and some risks of bleeding. But, you know, most patients tolerate the procedure very well. It is an invasive procedure, and for that reason, it should be reserved for patients who are symptomatic from their AFib.
Jim.
Yeah, and she has a hard time. She can't swallow medicine. She has to crush everything up. So the medicines that she takes now, she has to crush up. And the doctor was going to prescribe another one and try that. I don't know the name of the medicine, and come in and take EKGs almost every day and wear a heart monitor for a week to figure out what's what. But ablations sound okay for a 72-year-old who's not in great health?
So again, I mean, the age of 72, certainly plenty of people that age have this procedure done. That alone wouldn't be a contraindication. I guess it depends on, you know, when you say not in great health, what that really means from a medical standpoint. I think if she has got a lot of chronic kidney disease and, you know, bad chronic lung disease and these kind of things, then the risks of procedures increase. But her age alone wouldn't be a contraindication.
Okay.
If I have the time, she has sarcoidosis, which hasn't bothered her. She had breast cancer 30 years ago. She has no thyroid. She takes medicine and some other minor stuff. So that's all concerned. She has trouble coming out of anesthesia, too.
Yeah, so, you know, that's a consideration. You know, she's going to get some sedation for this procedure. So, again, I think that what it comes down to is if she's very symptomatic from the AFib, I mean, I think that's really what it comes down to. Then the small risks of this procedure may be warranted.
Okay. Well, Jim, thanks a lot. 800-348-2551 is our number. Another age-related question for you. This one came in via email. Are you having fun so far?
That's great.
It's almost over, man. Just hang in there. Joanna in South Hadley writes, my 75-year-old father had surgery to open both carotid arteries and then a quintuple bypass. His surgeon told him he needed to change his diet away from mostly meat and bacon to a mostly vegetarian diet. I helped him do that, and he was able to decrease his heart meds, and he lived until he was almost 88. Have you seen dietary changes help elderly persons with heart disease? And that's from Joanna.
Absolutely. I think, you know, lifestyle modification is you know, changing your diet, exercise patterns, this kind of thing, losing weight. This is not voodoo. I mean, there is good data to show that those kind of interventions really move the needle and reduce the risk of recurrent cardiovascular events and make people live longer. They can have dramatic effects. You know, dietary changes can have dramatic effects on cholesterol profile and blood pressure and sugar control. So and it's age independent. So just because somebody's 70 or 80 doesn't mean that these things aren't going to have benefit.
Okay, but devil's advocate time. The guy was 75, quintuple bypass. That's going to buy you X number of years, even if you continue to eat bacon and meat, right? How can you tell that the dietary changes when you're 75 and you live to be 88 made a difference? The quintuple bypass has made a big difference, right?
So the quintuple bypass surgery, where you create bypasses around the blocked heart arteries, or stents, where you go in and put in and open up one particular blockage in the heart arteries. Those things don't cure you of coronary disease. You know, you have those four or five bypasses, you still have extensive blockages throughout your arteries, right? You still have the disease process of coronary disease. So it definitely does not cure you of the underlying disease, and that's critically important. And, you know, ongoing aggressive treatment of risk factors is going to prevent the disease from progressing. It's going to keep those bypass grafts open. We know that people who take care of themselves and treat their risk factors, their bypass grafts stay open longer and don't close down after 2 or 3 years. So the surgical intervention is sort of treating the end stage of the disease because the risk factors weren't addressed in the first place.
You know, no offense to anyone who's up there. I'm up there myself. But at 75, you're at the end stage anyway. I mean, regardless of whether you're in perfect health or not, the finish line is in sight, yeah?
No, well, I mean, you know, I don't think so. I mean, I think, you know, 85 is the new 75, so to speak.
Really?
You know, I mean, I think that we're, you know,
write that down.
Because of how cardiovascular medicine has accelerated in the last, you know, really 4 or 5 decades,
yeah,
it's really changed the landscape of how we treat cardiovascular disease and how and the survival from coronary disease, myocardial infarction, and other cardiovascular-related diseases. People are surviving so much longer now based upon these treatments and diagnostic approaches that, you know, 75 is still relatively young.
All right, by the premise, by the gag, let's go to Morgan in Williamstown, Massachusetts. You're on with Dr. J.D. Philippone.
Thanks very much for taking my call. Back in January, I had a heart attack. I'm 55. I was in great shape. You know, 3 days before the heart attack, I did a 5-mile run, about an 8-minute pace. Following having 4 stents put in, I was on beta blockers and statins and so on and so forth. And I have experienced an incredible change in my respiratory ability for the negative, constantly wheezing. Feels like somebody's standing on my chest in a different way than an asthma attack, which I'm familiar with. I eat right. I exercise. Have always done that. And don't drink. Don't smoke. I do drink coffee a little bit. But are there issues? I've recently stopped the beta blockers because that was, from what I understood, potentially contributing to the shortness of breath. Things are better, but I still have some major issues. Could that be at all related to the cardiac events, or is this something brand new that's pulmonary?
Yeah, it's a great question. A couple of reasons that you could be out of breath and have diminished exercise capacity after a heart attack. One would be, you know, if there's significant damage to the heart muscle and your ejection fraction.
There was not.
Okay. So people who have reduced ejection fraction after a heart attack can be more out of breath doing things. It's a heart failure symptom.
Sure.
But, you know, with a normal ejection fraction, it would be hard. We wouldn't, you know, attribute shortness of breath to that. Beta blockers, which are an important medication after a heart attack. They're most important with people who have weakness of the heart muscle, reduced ejection fraction. But beta blockers can cause exercise intolerance. They can cause wheezing in people who have reactive airway disease or are prone to it. But they can also cause exercise intolerance because they blunt the heart rate response to exercise. They slow the heart rate down. So there's some people who just don't have the same stamina with exercise that they once did because of beta blockers. So certainly, especially if you're feeling a little bit better after stopping the beta blockers, I suspect that that was at least part of it. It seems less likely to me that you would, you know, coincidentally have developed a brand new pulmonary problem right on the heels of your first heart attack. So I think if you're still having symptoms, you definitely ought to talk to your cardiologist about additional testing or even pulmonary testing.
All right. Hey, thanks a lot for the call, Morgan. Appreciate it. This email from Stephen. I'm currently in the waiting room for my annual cardio exam and wonder if you could please offer any advice on an intelligent line of questioning. My background is that I recently turned 65. I'm a male in generally good health, but experienced a bout of Lyme and babesiosis a year ago, causing AFib, and I've been on 300 MSG of Tiadilt, a calcium channel blocker, ever since. What should I ask my cardiologist? That's from Steven.
Okay, so it sounds like you developed AFib and you're on Cardizem, which is a medication to control the heart rate. I would ask him about your stroke risk factors for atrial fibrillation and make sure that's addressed, because that's the biggest issue with AFib is that there's a risk of stroke associated with it. And depending on your risk of stroke based upon other risk factors, you may need to be on a blood thinner. So you definitely ought to find out about that. And then talk to him about what other risk factors you might be able to modify with regard to atrial fibrillation, your blood pressure, your weight, this kind of thing.
All right. Well, thank you for that. Let's grab one more very fast call for Dr. J.D. Philippone. Cindy in Ghent, if you can make it a very quick question, appreciate it.
Hi. Can you hear me okay?
Sure. Go ahead.
Okay. It is a quick question, and then I'm going to hang up so that we can all listen to you in the car.
Okay.
My son has developed compensatory veinage on the outside of his heart. He's a type 1 diabetic. To get around the two blocked arteries in his heart. Every time we ask the cardiologist about it, they just say, oh, it happens. So can you explain that to me, please? Thank you.
25 seconds.
So I think you're saying that he's developed sort of collateral flow around the blocked arteries. I think that's what you're asking about. So in people who have a chronically blocked coronary artery, other arteries will develop to sort of grow in and feed the area of the heart that isn't getting enough blood. And oftentimes that's adequate enough to prevent people from having symptoms from the blockage.
All right. Well, listen, great job, Dr. J.D. Philippone of St. Peter's Hospital. Did you have fun?
It was great.
That's the important thing. And thank you so much for being with us today. Support comes from Stinging Nettle Apothecary, Main Street, Catskill, New York, offering handcrafted organic herb-based products, incorporating natural herbal remedies into daily life. StingingNettleNY.com. Well, thanks again to Dr. J.D. Philippone of St. Peter's Hospital for being with us today. Thank you for listening. Thanks for the great calls. Thanks for the emails, et cetera, et cetera. If you didn't get through, apologies, but we will do this topic again. We have done it before, and we will do it again. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our own professional cardiac case over there in Master Control. Amber Sickle screened the calls. Well done. She's getting ready for the big fun drive June 10th, and she carved out an hour for us. Thank you very much. You can make her very happy by going to WAMC.org right now and help filling that lockbox. And she's making that money thing with her hands. Do that if you could for Amber. Hey, tomorrow on the program, it's Cars with Gordon Fricke. That's tomorrow at 2. We'll see you for that.